Welcome to the Speech Link. I'm your host, Shar Beauchart, and I invite you to listen and learn practical strategies from experienced experts to take your therapy to the next level. Getting a child to say a good er sound is one thing, but getting them to use it consistently is another. Now, you know the Easy R program for getting the er, but what about generalization? Well, what about the new R speech practice audios? Kids love to practice them, and you quickly access them via QR codes. Go to speechdynamics.com to take advantage of the 40% off sale price. Do it now. Hi, everybody. And before we begin, let's cover some disclosures. Regarding financial disclosures, Dr. Barron receives an honorarium for this podcast from SpeechTherapyPD.com. And she is an MGH Institute Postdoctoral Research Fellow, where she is a salaried full-time employee. And personally, I too receive an honorarium for the Speech Link, and I'm a presenter for SpeechTherapyPD.com and receive royalty payments. I own Speech Dynamics, Inc. And regarding non-financial disclosures, neither Dr. Barron nor I have any to report. So there we go. All right. So welcome, everybody, to our live Speech Link podcast, sponsored, of course, by SpeechTherapyPD.com. And I'm Shar Beauchart, your speech language pathologist host. And I'm so glad that you're here for our very beneficial topic, inner speech, exploring the connection between language and executive function. So Dr. Lauren S. Barron, PhD, CCC SLP, is a postdoctoral research fellow at the Cognitive Neuroscience Group at MGH, which is Massachusetts General Hospital Institute of Health Professions. And she's interested in child language and literacy disorders, executive function, and learning. Her research utilizes behavioral and electrophysiological methods, of which I'd like to kind of talk with you a little bit about that one. It sounds interesting. Methods to measure cognitive skills from multiple perspectives. And Dr. Barron's research interests are driven by her clinical experience in schools and private practice settings, which makes me happy. I like that. I agree. I think that's great. And also, her long-term goal is to develop more effective patient-centered interventions for children with language and literacy disorders. And she prefers for us to call her Lauren rather than Dr. Barron. So a hearty welcome to the Speech Link, Lauren.
Thank you so much, Cher. I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad that you are here. I'm really excited about learning from you. So yes, to begin, we have our hour here together. It's a pretty big topic, but there are many descriptions of executive function, and we want to lay a good foundation of knowledge for us over this hour. So what is your definition of executive function and then perhaps of inner speech?
Sure. I love starting here because you're right. There are so many different ways that people describe executive function and define it and the relevant pieces. So put simply, the way I think about executive function is that it's a set of cognitive processes that guide goal-directed behavior. There are typically three cognitive processes that comprise executive function. The first is working memory, sometimes referred to specifically as updating, or the ability to hold and manipulate information in the mind for short periods of time.
Okay.
The second would be cognitive flexibility, sometimes called shifting, the ability to switch between different tasks, focus on one and then switch to another, or to switch perspectives or change your approach, would all fall under cognitive flexibility. And the third component is inhibition. So deliberately stopping a maybe automatic or dominant response when necessary. Then the coordination of these three sort of core or simple executive function skills can contribute to more complex skills like problem solving, planning, goal setting. And all of these kind of fall under that umbrella of executive function. I did want to share, when I first started thinking about executive function and making the transition from clinical work to research, I was so overwhelmed with the number of different terminologies and definitions and frameworks. And there was a resource that I found really helpful. I don't think I actually included it in my reference list, but it's called the EF Mapping Project. And honestly, if you just Google EF Mapping Project, it's a group at Harvard. It should come up as the first or second document link that you see. And they just did a, you know, the whole purpose of their work was to take these 40 plus terms that people use to define executive function and organize them in a really clear and concrete way. And that's a big motivator for how I've organized my thinking around executive function. So I wanted to give that a little shout out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now I know the second piece you asked about is inner speech. So I'll give a brief definition of that and then we can kind of get it how they're related. But inner speech, also known as self-talk or internal monologue or dialogue, verbal thinking, it can be defined as the experience of language in the absence of any overt or out loud articulation. And it's very closely related to language. It's self-directed language. And so for most of my purposes, I assume that they're very similar skills. But of course, there could be some nuances there in one's language ability and how they communicate with themselves. So,
okay. And you said monologue and dialogue, where we kind of ask ourselves questions and then answer it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that kind of, really? Okay, because I know I do that. I didn't know if I was being weird or I don't know if I've ever talked about doing that.
It occurs across the lifespan, starts early in development. And while not everybody uses inner speech, I think we know some kind of famous cases of people who don't. I think about Temple Grandin and her analogy to thinking in pictures, right? Yes. So she's an example of someone who doesn't think in speech, The majority of people are having these conversations with themselves or with some kind of abstracted partner in their work and their goals. So,
Okay. Interesting. All right. Yeah. Well, good. So talk with us about the executive function and I guess those three areas and breaking them down for, I guess, did you want to start with the normal population or what is the ideal or what, you know, what we're supposed to all be doing?
And then hit
the ones that, you know, that we work with, the kids that we work with.
Yeah. And I'm just seeing a comment about repeating these three core executive functions. So no problem at all. The three core executive functions I think about are working memory or updating, cognitive flexibility or shifting, and inhibition. It doesn't have an alias. It's just inhibition usually.
Okay.
So these three abilities and really some underlying shared abilities. So this is a little technical, but one of the things that I've been seeing in the research is some evidence that suggests we have these three core skills that work together to solve tasks. But underlying them, there's this general kind of goal-directed behavior, which is sometimes referred to as a common executive function or this underlying ability that's keeping a goal in mind, working towards that goal. And there's, a working theory that inner speech is the tool that you use to influence the goal-directed behavior and any one of those executive function skills in order to change your task performance. So I started by defining executive function and inner speech, but we can think about where inner speech influences executive function. And it's this sort of underlying, you know, no matter what task you're doing, you're always working towards a goal in that task. And we think that inner speech is acting upon this underlying ability to maintain the goal and achieve it. And so I'll break that down a little into what we know from some of the evidence of typical populations. These could be children or adults and how they're using inner speech to complete executive function tasks. So, in its simplest form, it's kind of a self-cueing device that could remind you of the rules or the instructions of the task that you're completing, and then how you You might need to modify your performance as you're going in order to maintain your progress towards that goal. So I want to pause, let you think on it, ask a question. I can go into some specific examples if
okay.
that would be helpful.
Yeah, please do, because the self-cueing, I would think that you have to be alert to that and mm-hmm. kind of know what to look for or to watch for.
Mm-hmm. So I think it'll be helpful if we think about a concrete task example. So let's see. I think the one that might be most reachable is a lot of work comes from the Tower of London task. It's a problem-solving task where participants are asked to take a tower with different rings on it and move them to different pegs to match a visual presentation of another tower. So basically think of it like a puzzle. You have to use the minimum number of moves to move rings to different pegs and match a example that's been provided. And sometimes it's very simple, like taking off the top shape and putting it on one peg and taking the middle shape and putting it on the other open peg. But sometimes it involves moving multiple pieces around. So that's you can think about any kind of puzzle analogy where you're trying to solve a problem to match an end goal state. And so you can imagine that as you're trying to complete this puzzle, you might be looking at the finished product and saying, well, first I need to do this and then I'm going to do that. And oops, that didn't really work. So let me backtrack and move these pieces around another way. And I'm taking a lot of moves to do this. I better figure it out. And, this is something that, I'm drawing out, I don't think everybody experiences inner speech in this way. We know that the most mature and developed forms of inner speech do become a little bit abstracted. They become a little more coded and less fully formed sentences in our minds. And some of this comes from people's reflections on inner speech. It's obviously a hard phenomenon to measure. So it's a bit of self-report about how people use and experience inner speech. And sometimes in asking people to speak out loud during a task, which we would call private speech, it's self-directed. It's about the task, but it's not internalized anymore. And so we've kind of learned that inner speech moves from this, full sentences and self-regulatory form to kind of an abstract and maybe very personal form of condensed language that we used to say, put this piece here. And you mutter to yourself about little things, but not full sentences. You kind of, you and your inner voice have that own dialogue.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And that makes sense. And I'm going to say that most of us do it. And I remember, my husband, when he was, working on a car or doing some sort of a task, he was always talking to himself out loud, always. And it's, you knew exactly what he was thinking, but apparently it helped him to process that and maybe to remember where he put this piece and what needs to come next and, whatever. But he always did that. So I don't know if I ever have done any task to that extent, but that was the only thing that he ever did it with. And apparently it worked for him. Do we want to talk about any other areas of executive function, that's normal that we need to know about? I'm full of questions like, if we have a language disordered child and they're having difficulty verbalizing, are they going to have difficulty with their inner speech? Those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But do you want to talk some more about the executive functions or anything else you want to address?
Details. I mean, I agree that that's the meat of this. Like, so what's happening for our kids who we know language is not fully intact, but I will say we know a few more things about inner speech and executive function in typical populations. And your example of your husband doing this for a specific task makes me think of these, kind of just characteristics. We know that inner speech is only used on tasks that are of a moderate level of difficulty. So think zone of proximal development. If they're way too hard, you might not have anything to say. You might not have the language to help yourself through it. You might not be thinking strategically. You might just be trying to complete the task however you know how. And if it's very easy and familiar, automatic, you also don't necessarily need your inner speech to guide you through that task to maintain the goal and to finish it, because you can just do it without thinking, whatever, whether that's language or visuals. And similarly, familiar tasks. So the more you do a task, the less likely you are to use your inner speech. And the last little tidbit, so we kind of have something about task difficulty, task familiarity. The last little thing would be, if the task itself has lots of explicit cues and instructions embedded in it, there's not a lot that you necessarily have to say to move yourself through it. But if it's a task where the cues are maybe abstract or require a little bit more translating, then there's a need to use inner speech. So those are just a couple, extra things that we've been able to pick up about how kids and adults with typical language development are using inner speech on different kinds of executive function tasks.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. I mean, yeah, it makes sense. And we're talking about people and their thoughts. You know, it's such an interesting thing to think about people thinking and sort of trying to quantify that and qualify it. And, do you want to move into the more language disordered kids and sure. What's going on there? Okay.
Yeah. And, I'd love to tell you about another kind of measurement approach to inner speech. It's sort of continuing to build on this definition. How do we know what we know about inner speech?
Okay.
And I think before we get into kids with language impairments, it's really helpful to understand this other method of measuring inner speech, because kids who have a language impairment aren't going to be the most accurate self-report of how they use language necessarily. It's very confounded.
Yes.
So in a lot of the research literature that's tried to tackle this question, they're using a method called articulatory suppression. So we know about articulation, right? And the idea of suppression is that you're preventing someone from using any kind of articulation or inner speech during task completion. So if we think about that tower puzzle solving task again, articulatory suppression would be, okay, while you're completing this task, just repeat the syllable ba over and over and over again. So you're working on the puzzle and you're saying ba, ba, ba. And if you forget, a researcher might be reminding you to keep going, ba. And they've found that even this little syllable is enough to kind of clear the slate of whatever self-directed language you might be using. And what that does is allows you to say, well, how does someone do on this task without language? If you take the ability to use inner speech away by suppressing it, how do you perform? Often people who have typical development perform worse. They have lower accuracy, or they take a lot longer because they're trying to say the syllable and still talk to themselves. They're taking a lot longer. What some studies have found in kids with language impairment is that they don't perform any differently when they can use their inner speech or not, because it's not that effective for them.
Okay.
And this definitely depends. It's not a super consistent finding. I've been having some trouble replicating it with my own work, but we do see differences. We see these kids with language impairment taking a lot longer, maybe still performing as well, but taking a lot longer when they're, not able to use any kind of tools, any kind of language strategies. So they're performing differently from the typical populations. And we can get into that a little as we move through. I want to be a little more systematic in thinking about what we know about kids with language impairment. But yeah, so this method has been applied to these kids. And let me just jump down to my other notes to make sure I don't confuse anybody. Understanding that method is super helpful for getting through some of the next pieces.
Yeah. So it's kind of an interference kind of interfering with something that they may be thinking and substituting that with something that you want them to do, to say, bah. Did I grasp that?
It's sort of providing a baseline to compare kids with typical language and disordered language when you take the language piece out of it, because you're preventing both groups from using their inner speech.
Yeah.
You could argue that it is a little harder to complete two tasks at once while you're doing the puzzle and repeating a syllable, but it's pretty basic to repeat a syllable. And some experiments have done nuanced approaches or measurements to really show that there can be some specific deficits for typical children when this suppression is applied that suggest it's really a unique effect of removing the language, not just the task getting harder.
I think that would be an interesting thing to do, and because I would want to say, no, I don't want to say that word. I want to think about what I'm doing. Interesting.
And that's because you do use your inner speech quite often, it sounds like. So, you know, it is a strategy that you've developed.
Want graduate level semester credits for your SpeechTherapyPD.com courses? Well, they're available now in collaboration with the University of the Pacific. And as you know, most of our 750 plus video and audio courses are evidence-based and all are super practical. Subscribe now.
In school-age kids, people have done this, and depending on the study, they generally do find that the kids with developmental language disorders are performing at the same level of accuracy, whether they're using inner speech or not, whereas the kids with typical development kind of take a ding in their performance when they're not able to use the strategy that was available to them.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I still have questions, but where did you want to go?
Yeah, well, I'm happy to take one of your questions if there's a point that needs clarity or anything like that.
You know, as far, I mean, there's so many different levels and types of language impairments. And obviously, we're looking at the expressive one, but I guess also the receptive, but mostly the expressive. And have you been able to nail it down to syntax or vocabulary or just, you know, anything along those lines as far as specifics? Or are we just looking at inner speech as being this broad category?
You know, that's a really good question. In terms of this paradigm, measuring performance when you can use inner speech or not, we don't know if there's certain language that is essential to completing tasks. There is some sort of work that could be classified as intervention work that, you know, is kind of jumping us ahead to intervention, but it's not necessarily that it's inner speech, but we know certain types of language are more impactful for executive function. So you could assume that this language, whether it's spoken out loud or to the self, would improve your task performance. And I can go there now if you want. There are certain characteristics of language that are kind of at the sentence discourse level in terms of how you are thinking about actions. Like, are they future oriented? Are you thinking in sort of if then contingencies about behaviors and consequences? And some other studies have examined, like, even just the distance between the self and the task. If that becomes greater, you're able to, the psychological distance becomes greater, you're able to perform a little better. So those are some things that I was going to get into a little bit when talking about this as an intervention tool, but we can go there.
No, well, let's stay on you have a list there apparently. So those sound really interesting to delve into when we get to the therapy piece.
Sure.
Are there other things that you wanted to share with us? I don't want to interfere with that.
No, you know, I think I'll just sort of say the research evidence is still developing for this topic, because it's kind of a hard thing to measure how somebody's using their language internally. But we do kind of as a field think that kids with language impairments are using inner speech less often and less effectively. And I think there's enough evidence to just kind of summarize it in that way. Sometimes their inner speech is described as less mature. They may be more likely to speak out loud rather than to the self, which can be seen as a younger behavior versus that internalization. So these are just some different observations that I wanted to make sure I grabbed from different studies to summarize this.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say we can definitely pivot to kind of implications for the work, for the clinical work now.
Yeah. Yeah. So now you mentioned for the young children, does that equate to the self-talk when you have a child that's sitting by themselves and they're playing with their toys and they're sitting there talking to themselves and, you know, maybe doing the sounds of the cars and the other person that's doing, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Is that what you're referring to? Is it self-talk for the young ones? Is that kind of a precursor to the inner speech or an indicator of?
Yeah, so that's definitely what the theories would suggest. So a lot of people who think about inner speech give credit to Leonard Vygotsky for his role in kind of thinking about children's speech as a way of development, you know, self-directed language as a way of development, and this external dialogue that they first have as the way that they're learning about how to use language to shape their environment and to shape what they do. So it definitely starts as social communication, then it becomes self-directed talk, and then that becomes internalized. And we also know that executive function kind of develops in the same way, where first the parents are responsible for regulating the child, ensuring they're safe, helping them with things like inhibition or flexibility when things don't go as planned. And then the child will start to do that for their stuffies and their toys, and they're the regulator of their environment before they start regulating themselves. And then that becomes internal. So there's really nice parallels in what we think is the development for both of these things, which would suggest that they are related. So
very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very interesting. Okay. All right. So now, did you want to talk any more about assessment or analysis or anything along those lines as to what we can do, you know, as therapists that are working in private practice or, you know, in a clinic or in the schools or whatever, working with kids? What can we do? Do we just ask the parent questions? You know, did they go through these steps? Or, you know, what can we do to find out more information before we jump into the therapy?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. And it's one I've thought about a lot because executive function doesn't necessarily fall under the umbrella of all SLP caseloads. It does meet what Asha would say is, you know, part of our scope of practice. It's certainly a skill we're qualified to address, but a school-based SLP probably doesn't have the time and luxury to add on individual executive function goals when they also have speech and language goals to address for a huge caseload. Or there might be a school psychologist or somebody else who says, executive function is in my domain and they don't assess it. They don't really touch it. It really depends on where you are. So I've thought a little bit about, you know, what should SLPs be doing in this area? And with inner speech as a sort of connector of language to all things, really. So I think the methods that we have to evaluate inner speech are very research-based, not research-based, that's not the word. They're more designed for research purposes at the moment. You know, I don't think SLPs should be trying to do this articulatory suppression where they're removing language and evaluating performance. It's just not a great use of their time. We don't have standardized tests that do this. We don't have any way to kind of control for repeating tasks multiple times. So it's very much a research method. But I do think we're already doing classroom observations, like you said, parent interviews. We're already doing things where we could gather information about how obvious of a strategy this already is or is not for a child. We can try to observe if it's happening in the classroom environment, but also we could set up a kind of problem-solving, a semi-structured problem-solving scenario and see what they do or encourage them to share their thoughts out loud while they're working and see what they're doing with their speech while they're their inner speech while they're completing a task. And so I think that's kind of the extent of what assessment would look like. But I think in terms of the bigger picture of assessment, SLPs already know this, but there's a huge space for advocating for the role of language in completing pretty much any task. And this connection to executive function really highlights that. Even tasks that we might think are nonverbal, because you don't have to use words to complete them, you know, going back to this puzzle analogy of completing the tower task, you don't have to give a spoken response. You don't even really need that many verbal instructions. It's a pretty nonverbal task, but we've made it very clear you do use your language to complete this task. And so SLPs have sort of the knowledge and expertise to point out to other educators and people working with children that their language could really impact any domain of their learning and their growth and their education. So I think this kind of deeper understanding of the language they use internally can really be helpful in making that point in a broader educational assessment.
Yeah.
It's a heavy one.
We're getting deep here, aren't we?
Yeah.
You know what came to mind? I mean, you know, my brain always sort of turns to therapy and what I've done and whatever, but you know, the old standby of using barrier games.
Mm-hmm. I love barrier games.
You yes. too? I always loved barrier yes. games and just the different things that you can do with them and that you can emphasize and that you can learn and that you can slip in, you know? And I could see where just using barrier games as far as the memory piece, obviously the following directions, but, you know, I like them to verbalize, you know, what they're doing. And like, if they're putting I typically used blocks or, you know, that kind of thing, and then creating a structure. And, you know, I would say, I'm putting the yellow block on top of the green block, which is next to the blah, blah, blah. Okay. Maybe with the corner turned, blah, blah, you know, whatever. And then obviously you take the barrier away to see if they created the structure. But I'm wondering if maybe I should have had them, if it might have been beneficial to verbalize what they're thinking, what they heard, and what they're thinking, you know, when they're putting their blocks down, you know, so that would let me know if they got it and the vocabulary and what their brain is, how their brain is organizing it, maybe. I could see myself doing that a couple times to see if it was a good thing to do or not, if it was helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's the right idea. There's so many things we do with language or where we're positioned to take language and make it more external, more visible, more part of the process. Yes. There is, of course, you know, when some people might think, oh, well, your language is going to change a little if you're saying it out loud versus to yourself, knowing there's an audience, knowing someone could be evaluating it, you know, there's probably changes in how we use language when it's said out loud. Maybe there's some extra processing that then bogs down the other skills. But I do think, you know, we want to get the kids talking, and I think they're thinking all the time. So encouraging them to draw that out through different games and different things helps a lot. There's one study that has a lot of really rich examples of doing an intervention to train inner speech. And I love this study. And I also think there's a lot of, I'd love to talk to the authors about it one-on-one. Like, I'd love to really pick their brain because I want to unpack it. So they basically, this is, I did put this one in my references. I know it's Abdul Aziz and colleagues from 2016. And they had a 10 session over 5 weeks. So 2 sessions a week for 5 weeks, inner speech training program. Where, you know, before and after, they used this tower task, this puzzle to say, how did things change? But during the program, they used Legos and did Lego building activities and focused on several different things. What I love about the program or the study is that they were targeting inner speech as a strategy. They're looking to build it and grow it, but with these kind of multi-session programs, I'm like, what was the essential ingredient? Like, what was the most helpful thing?
Yeah.
So I'm gonna share what the goals were for each of their sessions to kind of give you a flavor of that and what I mean. So in the first two sessions, they encouraged the use of inner speech for focusing and paying attention. So they probably, I don't know exactly what they were saying. I don't know what their scripts were, but they were trying to draw out inner speech to say, all right, we're focused on a bridge building task. We're going to use these Legos and I'm going to talk about it while I work. I imagine something like this was happening with a clinician who was modeling and a child who was building and trying to also complete this task. In the next two sessions, they were trying to sustain attention and refocus their attention when they got distracted. Like, okay, we're doing the Lego task now. In the next two sessions after that, five and six, they were focused on developing a sequential plan for completing the task. So this makes me think of your question about types of language. My guess is they were starting to build some frameworks and narrative structures. Like, first I'm going to put the pieces like this or get the pieces that I need. Then I'm going to build my pieces up and, you know, like putting these kind of structures in place. So, you know, that's just the first half. They get through using verbal inner speech when feeling challenged and summarizing how to use them at home or in other places as sort of this last metacognitive session. So there's all of these great things happening. And ultimately, they all did have a positive impact on how these kids used their inner speech. But I don't know exactly what was helpful and what was said. And, you know, I would, you should invite them next. I'll listen to that one for sure.
Okay. Well, maybe we could get you in there too, because you know the questions to ask. You know, that might be a thing we could do, but we could talk about it later. But that is interesting. Well, there's so many components there. I'll have to find that article and see. Now, how old were the kids?
Those kids were a little younger. They were 4 to 7 years old.
Oh, really?
So, a little younger.
And were these typical developing kids or?
These were children with developmental language disorder, which is one of the kind of unique factors. I only have 3 or 4 studies that I know of that really kind of do an intervention of inner speech in this way that I really go to a lot. And then there's other work on just language and executive function, but there's really only a few that have tackled this because it is tricky.
It is tricky, but it is so needed. It is so needed. Yeah.
And I think there's probably a combination of direct instruction in here's a strategy you can use. You can use your own inner talk, like this sort of metacognitive teaching of strategies in a very explicit way, as well as, like I mentioned before, that modeling from the clinician. I don't think we know which of those pieces is having a greater impact on our kids with language impairment.
I bet both.
Yeah.
And a great deal of repetition in use.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a suggestion.
Repetition is a must.
How about you? It's a little beyond that.
Interesting.
That is so interesting.
Are you taking advantage of our new handy feature, the certificate tracker? Keep a record of all your CEUs, not just for any of the 750 audio and video courses here at SpeechTherapyPD.com, but from anywhere. Upload your certificates and voila, you have an organized, all-in-one-place record of all your CEUs. Cool.
You know, we're talking about interventions and so on, and I would love to hear more about that. But I also would like to know if you have maybe looked at the education field and see if they are doing anything with this. I think back to a few teachers that I had in the schools, you know, that I would go around and talk with them about their language kids, and they would say, well, this little girl, I'm just not sure that she's tuned in or that she's even thinking. And she would give, and you know, you never know where the breakdown is and which component is not plugged in. But, you know, the teacher was like, you know, she is, her summation was, at this particular example was she's waiting for us to tell her what to do.
Interesting.
Yes. She was waiting, get your pencil out, you know, or it's lunchtime. You know, she wasn't focused on, well, you put your books away and you whatever you do, you know, and you stand up and you go, and she wasn't getting it. And her, cognitive level was not impaired. You know what I'm saying? Maybe she was tuned into other things. Maybe she was distracted by things that were going on at home. I mean, there's always so many other things that can interfere. And so we're just focusing on our language kids, but I'm wondering, have you read anything in the education field that even looks at any of this kind of behavior patterns?
I'm not entirely sure about general or even special education specific work. I'm not very familiar beyond kind of speech language pathology and psychology work in this area. But I think that child you described sounds like classic executive function challenges where it's about getting started and feeling stuck. Kind of some attention and engagement challenges.
I think so too. And back then I didn't know enough to say anything, about executive function or any of those kinds of things. I don't know. I talked about giving her cues and, what should you be doing right now? You know, those kinds of things. I think it would be, I may look in the education field and see what they're doing, as far as executive function and that kind of thing. Because I think it would be really important for teachers to be addressing this and for speech language pathologists to be working with the teachers, et cetera.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it is really hard to think about how you can shape language to change executive function without thinking about the massive challenge that is targeting executive function. Notorious for kids who do well in the one-on-one clinical session, but crumble in the classroom. This generalization of executive function skills is hard, but that's one thing I really like about inner speech as a tool is that it's portable. It's practical. It doesn't require extra materials. It's really a strategy that if you can kind of get kids to use some of these self-talk scripts, that they can really benefit if with enough practice. I think there's more work to do. I'm happy to kind of revisit some of those language pieces I alluded to earlier.
Yes, please do.
And, in that example you gave about the little girl who didn't quite get started, there'd be instructions and she'd kind of just sit at her desk and not go up and get her assignment out of her bag. I want to first think about what I said, that language should be future oriented, and give a little shout out too to one of my clinical mentors, Sarah Ward, who I imagine people that are attending here with an interest in executive function might have seen her talk or heard about her work before. But her entire clinical model is centered around this idea of envisioning a future self and working to meet that end goal, which is a future memory, an episodic memory of the future of what that end goal looks like. And so all that means for your language is it should always be future oriented. So when the task is done, I will have my homework sitting on my desk and I'll have a pencil out so that I can mark along with the rest of the class. So it's all very future. I will have done this. I will, I will reach this goal that I'm visualizing. So that's kind of a broader framework for thinking about executive function that can sort of shape language. And that it's future oriented, you use future tense to kind of get yourself there. Mm-hmm. The next thing I mentioned was these if-then phrases, which a term I had not heard, I think it might come from education or psychology, is implementation intentions, this goal of doing something. So if-then phrasing is the most common, but this idea of you have an action you want to implement. So combining two of these things, the future orienting and these if-then phrases. So if I have to accomplish a complex task, then I need to complete these two steps first. And it can get more specific than that. So if I'm going to do this thing in the future, then I will need to follow these steps now. And it's all moving you towards the future and you're using your language. So this is one example where I don't know super well what the work on the language abilities are, but I think our kids with language impairment might have some weaknesses in organizing their if-then processing. So I think this would be a good one to target and continue working on. Yeah. And might already be a language goal that can then be applied to an executive function outcome as well.
Oh, that would be really good. Are there any activities or books or, you know, if-then examples that we could use in therapy that you know of? So we don't have to, like, you know what, invent the wheel.
I know.
Because I'm sure that there's a lot of things that we could do, but, you know, I'm not good with, like, just, you know, coming up with 10 of them on the fly. Is anything that you know of that we could use for examples to use in therapy? I'm putting you on the spot here, Lauren.
I know. I'm sorry. Nothing comes to mind right now. But, oh, I can do a quick search after this and follow up with you.
I think that is a good one. That's really going to make them, you know, focus on the end goal and then go back and think about at least two steps that they need to do in order to get there. I mean, that's, yeah. My husband could have used that. You know, I mean, that's
can't we all from time to time?
We all, exactly. You know, we do have a comment here from Cynthia. Yeah. Did you see that one?
I saw it pop up, but I'll take a second.
All right. It says language and interaction with parents may have an initial impact on children, and the lack of that interaction may lead to hesitation or seeming deficits.
I really like that comment.
amount, type of interaction. Oh, yeah. That's essential. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think what her point makes me think of too is that we don't know a lot about inner speech cross-culturally. We know, I'm pretty sure most of the studies I found are English speaking, probably predominantly white populations. And I'm going to assume there are probably some cultural differences in this concept of even talking to yourself. I know that kind of language-based thinking differs across cultures, how you have this dialogue or not. So I think there's a lot to explore there and, you know, how the parents support or cultivate that or not, or model it or not, is going to definitely influence how children use their self-directed talk.
Oh yeah. Huge. Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of therapists here that are throwing out some ideas from Lisa. She says traffic jam activities could work for if then. And I bet everybody knows about traffic jam, but I don't. Where can we access that? Or do we just Google it? Alisa. And then while she's typing or thinking or whatever, then we've got Cynthia. Copycat activities might be something to consider as well. Mm-hmm. And is that something formal or is that just do as I do, write as I write, dry as I draw? Are those specific activities, things that you buy or things that you make up?
Google.
Okay. She said, Alisa just said to Google the traffic jam activities. They are available online. I will do that. Okay. That sounds good. Traffic jam. What a fun name. Sounds like California when I was there. Yes. Yes, definitely. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not very familiar with either of those either.
I don't know either one either.
I'm in a bit of a research world and definitely looking to create projects that are, you know, examining this skill in clinical settings. So I love getting these ideas and thinking about it more implementation.
Look what she put. She put links. We should put links. I love it. Well, thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, Alisa. Thank you. That's so nice of you. And then Cynthia, talk or think as I talk and do. I've used it on my own for language stim. Okay, so that's copycat. Okay. Okay, mm-hmm. Talk or think as I talk. That's copycat. Okay, that makes sense. Using those are nice, concise, very direct, informative words for the kids. Great. Yeah. Thank you, ladies. Thank you.
I will say, Char, you know, the other strategies that I mentioned, the future orienting and implementation intentions, I haven't seen a lot of work on those skills specifically in kids with language impairment. And as we said, they probably would struggle with them and, you know, a good reason to target them. But I have seen one more, it's not so much a strategy, but just some sort of evidence that says sometimes simply exposing children to the language that is used to complete a task is enough to shape the language they use the next time they complete it. There's a study I think I included in the references by Doble and Zalazzo, where they looked at contrastive language. So saying these things are not the same, they're different, helped them do better on these kind of conflict resolution tasks in the end. And so this copycat example makes me think about that, mm-hmm. you know, even though our kids with language impairment might benefit from explicit instruction, they are still picking up on language models, probably with higher repetition, bombardment, things that we can provide exposure to, is definitely having an impact on how they use their language on tasks immediately after. And so this was one study that I highlighted as kind of a good example of training and shaping speech to affect executive function task performance.
Okay. And so, which author was that?
This was Doble and Zalazzo, 2016. And if I forgot any of these, I'm happy to update that reference sheet for you or okay. add a few examples.
Okay.
So.
All righty. Well, here's another activity from Stephanie. Yes. Toy theater parking lot. This could definitely encourage talking aloud about strategy for the cars that go, or to make the cars go, or where the cars go. I'm sorry. Strategy for where the cars go. If then. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Good.
These make me think of really great. These are great child examples of the sort of classic adult tasks where you say, you know, here's all the stores you need to go to on the map, and you need to do them in this order, and this one closes at this time, and you have to kind of, I think there might be a name for them, but they're like sequential logic puzzles. And I've used them with like adult rehab populations, but these seem like nice, tangible, similar level activities
of those
verbal problem solving. Yeah.
Yeah. And that kids can relate to. Mm-hmm. We can all relate to. Yeah. Yeah. Good. You know, I think, you know, when you and I talked a couple of months ago, I mentioned the thought of using questions in our mm-hmm. inner speech. And, mm-hmm. You know, without really understanding why I was doing it, it just kind of made sense to do it. You know, just making it through our day. We have to ask ourselves questions, you know, you know, should I get up now or should I sleep for 10 minutes? You know, what should I wear? Am I going to have, what am I going to have for breakfast? Oh, I'm out of toast. You know, well, then what can I have, you know, and should I take this route to work or this route? Or, you know, I mean, that's what we're doing, is asking ourselves questions to get through our day. Has there been any research studies on using questions at all, or any activities or anything that you know of that or research that talks about the importance of using questions? Because, you know, we talk about using questions, you know, and the formulation of questions, we have question cards and, you know, super duper and so on. But I'm thinking that we need to take it a step further for adding it to their inner speech or their inner conversation.
Nothing comes to mind specifically analyzing questions. However, I think what questions do is they prompt and create space for further inner thinking. So another study comes to mind where the key idea is that they've implemented a stop and think framework before children can respond to their items, you know, make their move, take their step, whatever it might be. They have to stop, and verbalize their responses to a stuffy that they have next to them or another animal or another character. And this stop and think approach didn't say, here's how you should use your language or what you should say, but it was sort of a say to yourself, pause, what should I do next? And that was enough to sort of maybe engage inhibition to then use problem solving more appropriately, shifting flexibly between your options and giving yourself the space to use that. So I think there might be work out there on question formation as it relates to executive function and strategies. I don't know, I'm not familiar with it, but I think there probably is a space where that questioning creates more thinking. And if we can teach kids to ask themselves the questions, it's a built-in strategy they can take with them.
Yes. Well, I think just the syntax, the whole structural piece, because so many of the kids that I had worked with, you know, provide a statement, you know, and kind of think of it as providing a question. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? There's a question.
Right, like question formation is a challenge. Yeah, for sure.
Yes, yes. So I always wondered, are they actually asking themselves questions to, you know, get through the day and so on? So, mm-hmm. Okay, we do mm-hmm. have some other information there, Cynthia. Okay, that was it. And then Stephanie, okay. Oh, Stephanie added toytheater.com/parking/. Good. Thank you. Thank you, Stephanie. And then Adara, I love using topic puzzles, grid puzzles with clues. I genuinely have difficulty with the puzzles that require math/order. And I use it as an opportunity to explicitly model my thought process and try to figure it out.
Huh. I love that. The genuine modeling. It's the best
logic
example there
puzzles.
Is.
Okay. So what, tell me what that is.
Grid puzzles with clues.
What would that be? Grid puzzles.
Some examples that a link.
Puzzles that require math or order. And I use it as an opportunity to explicitly model my thought process as I try to figure it out, which there you go. There's that example piece. Yeah. And then I'm assuming that we then ask them to verbalize as they're trying to figure it out. Yeah. Okay. And then Sylvia, thank you. If then can be goal directed, for example, if I want to blank, then I need blank. If I want to be a good swimmer, I need to take lessons or I need to practice. Can also be first, then in sequential tasks. For example, first put on socks, then put on shoes.
Yeah, those are great examples.
For getting dressed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Makes sense. Oh, these guys are on top of it. And then Adara. Oh, look, one of my favorite logic puzzle resources. There we go. Teachers pay teachers, of course. Okay, thank you. And then Adore, oh, she gave another one, another logic puzzle example. Oh boy, I'm going to have to save this one. Okay, you've got a grid and have to figure out which items go together. Okay, all right, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, makes sense. Ah, thank you so much, everybody. Wow. You guys are good. Yeah, very good. All right, excellent. You know what? We are close to, we've got about 2 or 3 more minutes here before I start wrapping things up. Lauren, is there anything else that you wanted to mention?
Let me just check. You know, Nothing really jumps out at me. I know we covered a lot. We went through a lot of technical information. I did just peek at my references and I'm thinking about a couple of the studies I mentioned today. I'll send you an updated list because I don't know that they're all there. But yeah, it's okay. A broad topic. Yeah. I'm really happy to have gotten to talk about some of the pieces related to executive function and specifically this role of inner speech.
Okay. Well, terrific. Thank you, Lauren, and thank you, everybody. And I do have a few things to say to wrap us up. So Thank you, Lauren, for being here and taking time out of your busy schedule and for sharing your great, very informative information. And in closing, I want to thank all of you for being here and for tuning in and for all of your good ideas, and also for continuing to get the word out about the SpeechLink podcast. And if you so desire, you'll be able to access the audio-only version on most popular podcast apps like Apple Podcast and Spotify and Podbean. And thanks so much for your supportive comments and your good reviews on all of those things. Thank you again, Lauren. And thank you to all of you. I hope you all know just how much you're appreciated. And thank you for all that you do for your therapy kids. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Char.
Take care. Thank you.
I'm thrilled you tuned into the Speech Link. I hope it was helpful. Just leave a quick review and subscribe to be a part of a select group that receives every episode. For CEUs, go to SpeechTherapyPD.com. And for everything else, visit CharBeauchart.com. There's free materials, articles, books, and my blog, Therapy Matters. Thank you for all you do. See you next time.
Thank you for joining us for today's course. To complete the course, you must log into your account and complete the quiz and the survey. If you have indicated that you are part of the ASHA registry and entered both your ASHA number and a complete mailing address in your account profile prior to course completion, we will submit earned CEUs to ASHA. Please allow 1 to 2 months from the completion date for your CEUs to reflect on your ASHA transcript. Please note that if this information is missing, we cannot submit to ASHA on your behalf. Thanks again for joining us. We hope to see you next time.